I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Pakistani officials say U.S. Predator drones fired 10 missiles near the Afghan border today, killing up to 15 people, including alleged militants, underscoring the role that unmanned aircraft play in President Obama's military strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and underscoring as well the seriousness of a flaw in the drone program that the Pentagon is reportedly trying to fix. Reports surfaced today that Iraqi militants, backed by Iran, hacked into U.S. drone video feeds in Iraq using an over-the-counter $26 software that its maker says was created to legally intercept content from the Internet. And the Wall Street Journal reports the militants may have also hacked drone videos in Afghanistan. Siobhan Gorman is intelligence correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, you write today that the Pentagon has actually known about this hacking since last December. What did it enable Iraqi militants to do?
Well, it allowed them to see what the United States was seeing. And so if spy aircraft is monitoring insurgents or monitoring the transfer of weapons or any other sorts of operations, then the militants would be able to see that as well. And the concern is then, of course, that they can use that information to evade U.S. operations.
Well, and what's the evidence Iraqi militants did this? And what's the software that enabled them to do it?
Well, the evidence was that military officials discovered the drone feeds had been downloaded onto the laptop of one of the militants that they had picked up, and they were doing it sort of frequently. They started to put efforts in motion to investigate what happened and figure out what needed to be done to correct the matter, and they kind of got those things rolling. But then in July, they discovered that when they captured a few more laptops, they found far more extensive use of this SkyGrabber software, and it looked like it was being shared among different militant groups as well, so that raised more concerns.
SkyGrabber software, this is the over-counter, roughly $26 software. Anyone can get it?
Yeah, it's available on the Internet, although I checked this morning and the website seems to be down. So, but yes, I mean, you can download it just like you could download any software off the Internet.
Well, and you write, in fact, that in addition to knowing about this in the Iraq region for about a year, the government's known about this flaw since drones were first used in the early 90s when the U.S. was involved in Bosnia. Why wasn't anything ever done about it?
Well, we were told that essentially the assumption was that local adversaries wouldn't have the technical capability to intercept these drone video feeds, and so it wasn't deemed necessary to encrypt and protect that information. I mean, this was 1990s technology, and in the 1990s, indeed, those capabilities didn't exist, but they're still using it now, and over the last couple of years, that capability has become freely available on the Internet.
And so what is being done about this problem now?
Well, they've gotten efforts in motion to encrypt the communications links, because basically it's the part where the pilotless plane is communicating with ground control and sending those videos back, and they're in the process of encrypting that information so that it can't be accessed.
Well, and you also write about a newer model drone that the U.S. is rolling out. It's called the Reaper drone, $10 to $12 million per vehicle. The Air Force expected to buy 375 of them, and yet they are not encrypted?
No, but my assumption is that with this effort to encrypt those connections, that they will be.
By the time they're bought.
At least at some point.
I'm sure the memo is going out as we speak. But we want to be clear, the hacking that was done by the Iraqi militants was of surveillance drones. Is there any sense that these attack drones that are being used in Pakistan have been at all hacked?
Well, we haven't seen any evidence that they have been hacked, no. Is the capability there? Possibly. So the U.S. is working to encrypt all of these planes at this point. So presumably that includes Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and other kind of key hot spots in the world.
Well, Siobhan, as you will know, this news today comes after a series of stories on the use of drones in Pakistan to kill militants there. Critics see it as an undeclared war. There are already questions about private contractors like Blackwater working with the CIA in the drone program. So given that heat, how embarrassing is this for the Pentagon?
Well, I don't know about embarrassing, but it certainly has pointed out a flaw that even they see they need to fix. So it's something that I think is catching people's attention internally.
Well, and one last question. It's one thing for militants to see what the U.S. sees through surveillance drones. In other words, they can leave an area, they can flag to other people that they're under surveillance, they can share surveillance. But what is the worst case scenario? What is the worst thing that can happen if they can hack into that video?
Well, there wasn't any evidence of anyone getting into the control systems of the plane. However, when the military discovered that the militants were downloading these video feeds, they did some tests in a lab-type setting to find out if a truly sophisticated hacker, like someone in the U.S. military, could find a way to exploit that unencrypted communications line to eventually get into the control systems. And they found that it was possible. They didn't find any evidence that it had been done, but they found that it was possible.
That's Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The wonderful new memoir, The Music Room, takes us back through two histories. One, the history of the author's house. William Fine's family home in England, Broughton Castle, is almost 700 years old. Kings and queens slept there. Parts of Shakespeare in Love were filmed there. And William Fine's takes us into every nook and cranny. But he also takes us past the private do not enter signs of the music room of the family castle into the rooms where he grew up with his brother Richard to take us through a history of the mind. Richard, 11 years older, suffered debilitating epilepsy and brain damage, and William writes about him as well.
I didn't question the world as I found it, our wide moat and gatehouse tower, the medieval chapel above the kitchen, the huge uninhabited rooms to the west and the parade of strangers that passed through them each year, the way our house was divided into two parts, one private, the other open to public view. I didn't question my brother's seizures or the frightening and unpredictable swings of his mood from gentleness and warmth to opposition and violence. These two were just facts I grew up among, how things were.
Author William Fiennes, reading from his memoir, The Music Room, and he joins us from the BBC studios in London. Welcome.
Hi, thanks, Robin.
What a pleasure to read. Part masterpiece theater, part sort of Sherlock Holmes medical mystery. The medical research on epilepsy. So what were you trying to figure out, this huge house or your brother or both?
I suppose both, really. I mean, the book began life not really as a book at all, but just me trying to remember my brother who died about, 5 years before I'd started writing. Mm-hmm. And I just began to feel that things were starting to slip, memories were starting to slip. So I had this idea almost of being a kind of salvage diver, that I was going down to the depths and pulling up these treasures from the seafloor and sort of rescuing them before they got covered over with sand. And that's how it started, really. But I suppose I thought I wanted to try and put Richard's experience of epilepsy and brain damage in some kind of much bigger context, historical and medical context. So although it's not in any way a comprehensive history of our understanding of the brain, that story, I suppose, is the story of my coming to terms with my brother's condition, an attempt to understand it, and I suppose an attempt to put it into a much wider panorama.
Well, and there are parallels, it would seem to us, between Richard's life and the life of the house, in that your parents, in order to sustain this huge castle, opened it to the public several times, opened it to film and theater companies, and you tell us about, you know, looking out the window and seeing well-known actors put on plays. But they also had to keep the public out of a certain portion of the house that was very dark and mysterious, even to you. And then your brother also, he could be unpredictable. He would go out in the public, certainly, but then there were also times when your parents had to maybe shield him from the public, like they did a part of the house, just to protect him and them.
Yes, you're right. Both the house and Richard, they both have a kind of public face. And then something else going on behind that. Mm. And definitely in the house, I mean, it was this kind of crazily big place, and I'm slightly embarrassed about growing up in such a big house, but it was, I mean, incredibly beautiful and surrounded by a moat and battlements and all the works. It had been in my family for hundreds of years, 600 years, actually. But we lived in a sort of small bit, and then there was a door in the music room, and that led into this other end of the house, what my mum and dad always called the other end, and that was the bit that visitors would kind of walk through when the house was open to the public, the great hall and the long gallery and these rooms with suits of armour in them and swords and muskets and all of that kind of stuff. And as a little boy, I was always sort of gradually pushing through the door in the music room and trying to be bold enough to explore that other end. So I think in the book, the house becomes a kind of psyche with a conscious mind and an unconscious mind.
Mm.
And in a way, it's a story of this boy kind of growing up and gradually exploring that other side, that subconscious side, with all its strange images and presences.
It sounds astonishing. At one time, British soldiers lived there. People who were evacuated from a bombed London stayed there. Describe further some of these rooms and what was in the house.
The house was first built in 1300 and then extended in 1550. And so it was quite a pivotal place in the English Civil War, which was the 1640s, really. And soldiers were definitely billeted there during the Civil War. And so what most people would call the attic, we always used to call the barracks, because that's where the soldiers slept, right on top of the house. And when I was growing up, those were kind of strange gable provinces filled with the weirdest things, trunks spilling with letters and old paintings and old pictures and tricorn hats and cutlasses and sort of all a kind of wonderland, actually, for a small boy. And, you know, I was always overwhelmed by the beauty of the place. But it was a strange upbringing. I mean, this sense of great wonder and history and natural beauty, but also a kind of isolation, growing up on an island surrounded by water with a sense of some big world on the other side of the water.
You learned to ride your bike in the Great Hall. Your mother would have to water a rug. Now, explain that.
Yes. We had one carpet that was called a rush matting. So it was, I guess it was made of rushes. And to keep it from drying out, she had to water it. So she would wander back and forth across it with a watering can, like just watering it like a lawn, basically. But I think all of the kind of life of the castle is full of unexpected things. All the chores you've got to do, I mean, not just kind of cleaning the kitchen and the regular things, but then, you know, oiling the armour with WD-40, some kind of household oil, motor oil. That's something that most people don't have to do. But I hope that in the music room, in the book, you know, there is this kind of strangeness and curiosity of the background, of the backdrop of the book. But really, in a way, when I was writing it, that was secondary in my mind. I thought, well, I know I've experienced this unusual childhood, but really what I'm writing about is not unusual. It's about a family coping with some difficulty, coping with some otherness.
Sure.
And that's really something universal.
And we want to hear more about that struggle and your brother's epilepsy. That's William Fiennes, author of the memoir The Music Room, a memoir but also a history of the mind, from the early Greeks, who called epilepsy the sacred disease because one was thought to be seized by demons as a punishment from the gods, to early experiments with electric eels to try to influence the brain. We now know that epilepsy is a neurological condition that causes disturbances in electric signaling in the brain. Untreated, it can do terrible damage, as we're going to hear. We'll have more with William Fiennes in 1 minute. Later today, also want to let you know, we'll have everything that's true about online shopping and sales taxes. You are paying them, aren't you? Back after a break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with William Fiennes, by the way, a cousin of Ray Fiennes, the actor. William's memoir of growing up in his family's nearly 700-year-old English castle they could barely afford with an epileptic brother is called The Music Room. And William, in your book, your brother Richard looms as large as the castle. He had severe epilepsy starting in his teens. Tell us more about that and what effect it had on him.
When he was 13 or 14, he had what's called a status epilepticus, which is where you go from one seizure into another and then into another, with no period of recovery in between. And that left him with permanent damage to his frontal lobes, the bit of the brain behind the forehead. And it was really that brain damage that, that made him often quite difficult to be around. I mean, he was this incredibly generous, wonderful person, soulful person. But, I mean, people who have frontal lobe damage tend to find it quite difficult to get started on things, difficult to stop doing things once they're started, difficulty in putting themselves into other people's shoes and seeing the consequence of their actions, quite violent mood swings and things like that. So he was much, much loved. I mean, we adored him, but he was sometimes very difficult to be with. Yeah. And what I saw when I was thinking I'd like to write about Richard was, well, you're partly memorialising him, putting up a statue to him in a park, as it were, but also a sense that here was an experience of great a sort of beauty and wonder, and but at the same time, you know, experience of difficulty and pain and loss, really.
Well, let's talk about the beauty and the wonder, because I'm thinking, first of all, of the way he was with words. He told your mother one day, "The day is starting the ignition of life."
Yeah.
He after he was on a plane ride, he says, "My heart went sunk." Didn't yours?
Yeah, and looking out the window, he said the clouds looked like footprints in snow.
Yeah. As he got older, he had a very gentlemanly way about him. He wore a bow tie and smoked a pipe.
Yes.
And yet, the violence. I mean, at one point, when he had this tremendous mood swing, almost turned into another person, smashed windows of the castle, arguing with your parents, and you were, you know, frozen on the stairs watching this. The violence meant that he had to live outside the home for a while.
Well, he needed proper care because the seizures were potentially dangerous events, and he needed something closer to a normal life. And living in an epilepsy center, he was able to have something close to a job. I mean, he could go to the horticulture unit every day and work, and that was an incredibly happy thing for him. Mm-hmm. But when I was growing up, there were lots of difficult moments.
Well, you're very honest. You say now you want to have a loving monument to him, but when you were a little kid, you're very honest about how you might provoke him. He bothered you. It bothered you that you could see as a child how your sainted parents worked so hard with him. And you know, you weren't past taking him on.
Yes. I mean, I was trying not to sort of sentimentalize anything. And although I was excited to write about all the wonderful memories of Richard, I remember when trying to describe things he was doing that weren't so happy, I felt a kind of, on the one hand, a sort of guilt that he had such a capacity for remorse and he knew that that wasn't his best self. I felt sort of bad sometimes making that part of the story, but at the same time I knew that anything else would be a kind of diminishing of him. It was partly the bigness of his personality, of his character, that he could contain those moments and transcend them, actually. And there was this idea of acceptance that even when Richard was being very difficult and sometimes aggressive and violent, there was still a sense that he wasn't being malicious. It wasn't nastiness in him. It was simply that something wasn't working right because of organic damage in his brain. So you just had to be patient, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that comes through is your parents, who were the ones doing so much accepting. They seem just lovely. And at one point, you find your father leaning with one hand on the house and his head bowed. What was that exchange?
Well, I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was asking the house for some of its strength. To me, they're, along with Richard, the heroes of the book, really.
Are they still in the house?
They are, yeah. My dad's 89 now, so, and they still sort of full-time looking after it, trying to keep the tiles from falling off and all of that stuff.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was thinking, too, that, you know, ultimately, yes, you do become a young man who felt so protective of your older brother, as did your parents. And then you just mentioned your parents also feel so protective of the house. And I remember you did as well. There was a point where you were walking out on the roof and you felt badly because you knocked a tile off.
Oh, yeah, the moment you're talking about, I used to clamber about on the roof, and at one point a tile came loose, and that tile had been there since the 16th century, and I felt really bad about it. And as I say in the book, it wasn't because I was worried about being punished or anything. It's just that I had some idea that the house was a sentient being, vulnerable to injury. Because actually, I think that's sort of at the heart of the book. Somebody asked me if I could say what it was about in one word, which is a slightly weird question maybe, but the answer came up from my inside somewhere, and which was care. I think it's really about care, the idea of care, not just of the people we're close to, but also the world we inhabit, the places we inhabit, that throughout the book there's a kind of duty of care, I suppose, to place and to people.
Well, and as you said, your brother dies quickly, too quickly. And you thank a friend in the book who quoted psychiatrist Carl Jung to you. His words were, "The beloved dead are our task." Mm. So it sounds like that's what you're saying, you feel a responsibility.
Well, I suppose that Richard wasn't the sort of person who gets an obituary in the papers. On the other hand, you know, he was an incredible presence in the world. And I suppose I wanted to sing about that a little bit.
Well, a wonderful read. And thank you so much for talking to us about it.
No, thanks for having me.
Again, that's William Fiennes. His lovely memoir is The Music Room. By the way, his first book was the award-winning The Snow Geese. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, the climate talks will be wrapping up. We'll have a report from Copenhagen, but also author Wally Lamb, who has channeled his inner Gene Shepherd for a new Christmas novel. That's tomorrow. Still to come today, are you shopping online or from catalogs or crossing state lines? You may own sales tax. Latest news is next, Here and Now. As temperatures drop across Europe and people turn up their thermostats, attention is again turning to where that energy will come from and whether the supply is secure. Many Europeans heat their homes from natural gas, which comes from Russia through Ukraine. Earlier this year, you might remember a dispute between Russia and Ukraine over gas prices, exposed corruption on both sides, and left consumers out in the cold. Now there are concerns that Naftogaz, Ukraine's state energy company, won't be able to meet its payments to Russia. And the question is, will Russia turn off the taps again? The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse reports.
The start of this year was a turbulent one for the gas business. In January, a dispute between Russia and Ukraine led Moscow, not for the first time, to switch off the taps. As a war of words raged between Kiev and the Kremlin, hundreds of thousands of people in the European Union shivered in their unheated homes. The following month, there were extraordinary scenes at the Naftogaz headquarters.
Three masked men in black outfits with machine guns guarding a door.
The Ukrainian security services, controlled by the president, had raided the offices of the state energy company, controlled by the prime minister. Ukraine's internal political tensions had spilt into the open. At stake was control of the multi-billion dollar gas import and transit business.
This is an internal Ukrainian problem that has to be solved.
Niko Langer is in charge of the Ukrainian branch of the German think tank, the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, which is closely associated with Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats. Germany is one of the largest consumers of Russian gas, and Mr. Langer is a veteran observer of the gas trade here.
There are many, many people in political elites who are still, who made money out of this and are still making money out of this, and they will prevent a real reform in this sector.
On the face of it, there should be no problem. Russia has huge reserves of natural gas, which Europe needs. The question is how to get that energy from the gas fields of Siberia to its European customers. Under Stalin, the Soviet Union began construction of what became an extensive network of pipelines running from the east, funneling that gas into vast storage facilities on its western border, from where it could be easily supplied to Europe. This trade continued even during the tense standoff of the Cold War. Supply and demand trumped ideology. When the Soviet Union collapsed, though, Gazprom, the Russian state energy giant, suddenly found that crucial elements of that network were located in a different country, independent Ukraine. Still, for a decade and a half, the trade continued uninterrupted. Ukraine got cheap subsidized gas in return for allowing Moscow to effectively control the pipeline and storage system. Then everything changed. The Orange Revolution in the winter of 2004 installed a pro-Western president in Kiev. Viktor Yushchenko early on made it clear that he was no longer willing to dance to the Kremlin's tune. Niko Langer.
The control over the Ukrainian gas system is a question of Ukrainian sovereignty and finally of Ukrainian independence. If the Russian side, and this, I think this has been and is still the long-term interest of the Russian side, if the Russian side gains control over the very huge transport system that is installed in Ukraine, this is a danger for Ukrainian independence.
The European Union has made it very clear that it wants to see wholesale reform in the Ukrainian gas sector to make the business more transparent. But, says José Manuel Pinto Teixeira, the EU's top official in Ukraine, vested interests are still muddying the waters.
There are interests that are moving around the gas business in Ukraine, and of course that contributes to influences into the process which may contradict our overriding objectives.
Last month in Yalta, the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin signed a new agreement with his Ukrainian counterpart, Yulia Tymoshenko. Russia agreed to waive stiff penalties for Ukraine, making it easier for Kiev to pay its bills. There'd be no repeat, they said, of last January's crisis. But parts of the deal have not been made public, and it's far from clear what concessions Ms. Tymoshenko has given Moscow in return for this guarantee while she runs for the presidency. While the gas trade is conducted in backroom deals shrouded in secrecy, it will continue to be a potential instrument of geopolitics, and Europe's energy supply remains far from secure.
That report from the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse. Well, up next, are you seeing boxes pile up on your neighbor's front porch? Are they online orders? Are they paying sales taxes? One lobbyist proposes turning them in if they're not. In 30 seconds, here and now. Did you know as you go about your Christmas shopping, you may be guilty of tax evasion? Because even when you're not charged a sales tax, you may still owe it. It could happen when you order from catalogs or call those, but wait, there's more, toll-free TV numbers or cross state lines to shop or order online. And that's the big one. It's predicted that while total retail sales will dip slightly this holiday season, online sales will grow 8% to nearly $45 billion. And that adds up to a lot of tax revenue states should be collecting and desperately need, but probably will never see. And that's just for holiday shopping. For all of 2009, our next guest says states will lose out on about $15 billion of unpaid sales tax. Scott Peterson is executive director of the Streamlined Sales Tax Governing Board, an organization of state legislatures trying to streamline tax laws. We're going to hear more about that. But first, Scott, lay out the basics. Why do online retailers or catalogs not charge sales tax?
They do so because of two different Supreme Court cases, one in 1967 and another in 1992. The Supreme Court said that the complex nature of individual state and local sales taxes was an undue burden on interstate commerce, and states were prohibited from imposing that burden on a retailer unless the retailer had a physical presence inside that state.
And all states but five have the sales tax, and the five that don't are Alaska, Delaware, Montana, New Hampshire, and Oregon. And the states that do have the sales tax, of course, have no way of knowing who's buying what online. But their laws say that people have to pay taxes on what they buy. So how do states, if they do try, how do they try to collect that tax?
They do it in a variety of ways. They audit people. Which is a very inefficient way of collecting the tax. It's very expensive to audit, and it creates a fair amount of animosity. You'll see in most states with an income tax, you'll usually see a line on the income tax return that says if you have purchased anything from a catalog or over the internet, that's taxable and you should remit your use tax. That's what it's called. It's called a use tax.
And we understand some states have different ways of doing it. I think Vermont does some sort of a monthly audit. They require filing a tax return by the 20th day of the month to avoid a $50 late fee or a 5% penalty per month. So some states are trying to recoup this tax money, but it's hard. And then it gets even more complicated. We mentioned that if online companies or catalogs begin to have a brick-and-mortar physical presence in a taxing state, consumers in that state have to pay a sales tax. But even if they don't have that physical presence, at least one state, New York, is trying to get a sales tax money. And this is from Amazon. What is New York doing regarding Amazon?
One way that states have been trying to get their use tax collected is to redefine physical presence. If I have a website, and if I put a link on my website to somebody else, like Amazon, and somebody clicks on that link and then goes to Amazon and buys something, I could get a commission from Amazon for that sale. And what New York is saying is that the fact that the New York organization received a commission for a sale was a physical presence for Amazon.
So as a result, if you live in New York and you buy anything through Amazon, a line will appear on the online purchase form calculating your sales tax. Now, Amazon is fighting this law in New York, but states like Rhode Island and North Carolina are looking to copy it. That's why Overstock.com is cutting ties with affiliates in those states so they don't have to charge the sales tax. Meanwhile, there's a bill in Congress that would allow all states to charge the sales tax, even if there's no physical store presence. But we understand before Congress will pass that law, there's got to be a uniform national sales tax code. And that's where your group comes in, the Streamlined Sales Tax Governing Board. Who are they?
23 states are currently members, much of the Midwest, some of the South and the Northeast, and a little bit in the West. Mostly either state tax administrators or state legislators, the two entities that are naturally involved in trying to make sales tax administration simpler.
Well, and the idea is to make state tax codes more uniform because it's complicated there as well. We understand New York has an exemption for clothes costing less than $100. They want a lot of people to shop. California has a partial exemption for farm equipment. So each state has their own thing. And then you have states like New Hampshire, north of us where we are in Massachusetts, no sales taxes at all. They hold onto that like a tenet of a religious faith. How are you going to get states to make these changes?
It's actually quite difficult. A recent example was the state of Massachusetts. And the state of Massachusetts exempts clothing that costs less than, I think, $175. And they tax all clothing above $175. We told Massachusetts, if you want to be a member of Streamline, that's inordinately complicated for retailers to administer, so you have to get rid of that. It was $100 million. They said, we can't give up $100 million.
Why is it easier for Congress to pass legislation if it's more uniform?
Because the hard work is making it uniform. It's unrealistic to ask a member of Congress to vote to change his own state's tax law. That state should change its own state tax law, and they should go to the member of Congress and say, we've made the system better. We've improved it for retailers. It costs them less of their own money to administer our sales tax. We think we've met the standard that the Supreme Court set. Please give us the authority to require every retailer to collect our sales tax.
Right. What's your sense of where this is going to end up?
The states are going to continue to try to collect that uncollected tax, and that Congress will realize that it's a lot less trouble passing that law than some of them think it is today. I'm concerned that if this fails, we'll go back to the days where our primary method of getting the tax collected is to drag people into court. And that's just a very inefficient way of collecting taxes. Yeah. I think as states and local governments continue to cut their budgets, citizens are going to start to see where the services that they used to get are no longer provided. And that's going to occur to them that, you know, I do all my shopping downtown and I pay all my sales tax, but that truck keeps showing up at my neighbor's house dropping off all these packages, and I really wonder whether or not my neighbor's actually paying their sales tax. And
Big Brother, so you think will handle it?
Well, I would like to think that, you know, as good citizens and as good neighbors, we encourage ourselves and our neighbors to do the right thing, and this is clearly the right thing because that fire truck that shows up is going to show up whether I pay my taxes or not. And I think the people that pay the taxes are going to realize and maybe start to apply some more pressure to the people that aren't, that, hey, we're all in this together.
That's Scott Peterson. He's executive director of the Streamlined Sales Tax Governing Board. Geez, you know, be careful how many of those Harry and David boxes are sitting on your porch. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Every year about this time, there's at least one little child who asks, how do we know there's a Santa Claus? How do we know? Well, it's all in that magical book one father found when his car was stuck in the snow that time in the Rocky Mountains.
The Green Book. Being the true and authorized chronicle of Klaus, sometimes styled Father Christmas, Père Noël, Santa Claus, and sundry other names, including, wrongly, St. Nicholas. Also, a record of important recent events of the last few centuries at Castle Noel in the True North, together with production figures and an almanac of Christmas flights, written and compiled by Dunstan Wyatt, E.S., court historian.
And here's where we will ask parents to excuse their children, because from here on out, this is top secret stuff. Are we alone? Okay. That narrator is Tim Slover. He's a playwright, University of Utah professor, who came up with what he calls the Christmas Chronicles for his own two boys when they were kids. And now they're being produced as a series of 30-minute radio dramas to air on KBYU Public Radio in Provo, Utah. And Tim joins us from their studios. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And so you actually, you know, kind of made this up as you went along when your sons asked you questions?
Okay, I'm going to tell you something, Robin, it's going to sound sort of odd and sort of shocking, but I'm just going to say it anyway. To me, the feeling that I had as I was telling my boys these accounts was not of invention, but of reportage, of memory. I don't quite know what to make of it myself. So I don't want to sound like a crackpot. Yeah, I made these stories up. All I can tell you is it never felt that way to me.
It felt like they were delivered to you.
It did. It felt like there was a reason for it. Frankly, for me, if anybody just gets a little bit of extra pleasure out of Christmas as a result of these broadcasts, I'm thrilled, because I think that Christmas sometimes has gotten a little debased lately, and I think also that Santa Claus has gotten a little silly lately. So my impression is that this is just one way to maybe combat the kind of grayness and the kind of cynicism and the kind of depression that has settled over Christmas of late. And now I get the opportunity to tell more people about it, and I'm really thrilled for that.
Well, let's ask you for some of the answers to all those questions that kids ask. Who is Santa? Where'd he come from?
He was a human being named Klaus, who lived in the 1300s in the Black Forest region of what's now West Germany, or now Germany. He was a real person. He really lived. He really was a member of a carpenter's guild, and he really did make toys.
And then how did he go from that human to the superhuman who delivers presents to kids all in one night?
Over a process of many adventures and a process of time, actually, is how it happened. The first thing that happened to him was that, tragically, as happened a lot in that particular horrible century, is that the Black Death came to his village, and although he was spared, a lot of children died, and so he got an idea, and the idea was that he would solicit children in helping him in his carpentry work to rebuild things in the village that had been lost. And then at the end of that year, he felt he should reward them with toys. That's sort of how the whole toy delivery began.
Wow, you're good. This is good. Well, so continue. How did it then become a worldwide thing?
As you can imagine, as he started delivering toys to the kids in his village, other kids in other villages found out, and his deliveries became more and more far-flung. That got too much for him at some point. And the first event that helped him was a young woman who, by dint of hobby at least, a racer with a reindeer whose name was Dasher, and found him in despair in the middle of a snowstorm, unable to deliver his toys to all the children that were expecting them. And so that's how he first started delivering them on a sleigh. Before that, it had all been tramping around on foot.
Well, then the reindeer take flight. Here's a clip from your readings of the Christmas Chronicles where Klaus takes that first flight.
Klaus's first flight was more glorious than any of us who have not ridden in a sleigh pulled by flying reindeer can ever know. After a few moments of initial vertigo and not knowing up from down, he took to flying in his sleigh as if he had been born to it, which of course he had. He exulted in the wind blowing through his hair and at the sight of the sleeping villages below and the wheeling stars above. And when he thought of how quickly he would be able to get his toys to the children now, and then when he thought that he could be let down to a roof rather than having to climb up to it, and then finally when he thought how quickly he would be back by Anna's side, sheer joy bubbled up in him. He began, and then noted as he warmed to his theme, and then finally in his deep, rich bass, ho, ho, he laughed as he sailed through the roaring winter night.
And we heard just now the voice reading this was not yours. It was Richard Johnstone reading the voice of Dunstan Wyatt, the court historian.
Dunstan Wyatt, when he was living on Earth in mortality, was a professor of English Lit at Exeter College at Oxford University. And because of his interest in history, after he passed on, he was called up to Castle Nowell and became the court historian, E.S., by the way. Elevated spirits, the slang that's used in the True North for elevated spirit is elves. You may have heard that term. And those are the people that help in all manner and sundry ways, Klaus, both with his deliveries and with his toy making now.
Is this the kind of thing you said to your kids when they asked these questions?
Totally. The question my kids asked more than any is the classic, right? How can he deliver all those presents in one night?
Right.
The answer to that turned out to be nothing to do with religion and everything to do with physics.
And is it too complicated? Can you share it now? How does
it's not complicated at all. In the True North, they know it as chronolepsy. Although the Elvish slang is time stop, it happens only on Christmas Eve when Klaus and the eight flyers, which is what they call them in the True North, set out on Christmas Eve. They're granted a special ability as they go through, actually, the Aurora Borealis to stop time, only for them, only for them. They have months, if they need to make all of these deliveries and sometimes take that long. And so it was really sort of scientists who figured that out in the True North, but it happened sort of all at once. And that's one of the stories that's told in the Christmas Chronicles.
That's Tim Slover, a University of Utah professor and playwright and author of the Christmas Chronicles, which are playing on KBYU for the first time this Christmas. You can hear them at our website, hereandnow.org. Tim, just a couple last quick questions that have come up here. How does Santa get down the chimney?
Doesn't need to anymore. That was a problem. He never actually went down chimneys. But how he does it now is called the Maya principle, and it's one of the things he learned from the Dalai Lama. He can actually go through walls when he needs to.
And how do you explain all those wannabes in the malls?
There is no explanation for that. I mean, to the extent that they're good-hearted and are trying to help children have a good Christmas, Klaus is all for them. But as you know, it can get a little commercial, a little sinister, from a capitalist point of view. Mm-hmm. They're not in any sense kind of emissaries or anything like that.
Tim Slover is a University of Utah professor and playwright and author of The Christmas Chronicles, which are airing on public radio at KBYU. To hear the radio dramas, we'll have them on our website, hereandnow.org. And the Chronicles are also going to be published by Random House next fall, so we'll let you know about that as well. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you.